Welcome back to Gray Matters, the podcast of the Seaboard and Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State. I'm Jace Lington, the Gray Center's research director. Joining me today is Adam White, co-executive director of the center. Hi, Adam.
Hey, Jace. Good to be back.
Today, we're also joined by Paul J. Roe. He's the director of the Thomas A. Roe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And he's also the former administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. Paul recently wrote a working paper for the Gray Center critiquing the idea that agency expertise justifies judicial deference to agency statutory interpretation. Paul recently delivered some remarks based on this paper that will soon appear in the George Mason Law Review Forum as part of the Gray Center Symposium on the Future of Chevron Deference. You can find his paper on our website or by clicking the link in our show notes. Paul, welcome to Gray Matters.
Well, thanks, Jace. Really good to be here. And Adam, good to be here with you as well.
So your article is called Lover, Mystic, Bureaucrat, Judge, The Communication of Expertise and the Deference Doctrines. That's quite an evocative title. Can you tell us a little bit about what your paper's about?
Yeah, absolutely. So the title is in tribute to the way the idea for the paper came to me. I was reading a fascinating short work by Jacques Maritain on connatural knowledge and the role of this Thomistic concept in natural law theory. And a point that Maritain makes is that there are various kinds of knowledge that warrant the name knowledge, but that are not capable of explication from one person to another. And one way you might come upon such knowledge is to have an experience and then reflect on the experience and glean knowledge from the experience that you're not able to give to another. So in the field of psychology, a famous example asks the question, what is it like to be a bat? How do we even talk about that question? Right. If I were to become a bat for the day, how would I tell you tomorrow what it was like? Right. We run into the same problems of communication with primary sensory experience. So seeing the color red, there's just no way to explain what it's like to see the color red to someone who hasn't seen it. I was reading this essay by Maritain, and it occurred to me that much of the discussion of the expertise rationale in judicial opinions treats agency expertise as if it were incommunicable knowledge, the kind of knowledge that Maritain suggests one might have from religious contemplation, from reflecting on one's own inner directedness towards human thriving, perhaps the kind of knowledge you might have of your closest friends and family, from living with them daily and loving them. And it seemed very strange to think that regulatory knowledge was like any of those other kinds of knowledge, for various reasons that I suppose we can get into in the course of this podcast. But that was the governing insight, that that there are different kinds of knowledge that human beings can achieve, and it seemed at least highly questionable that the kind of knowledge that agencies possess and use is similar to this other kind of knowledge that is incommunicable.
Well, since your most famous government service was as administrator of OIRA, you've seen agency expertise up close firsthand. Could you give us a sense, maybe from that perspective, as you talk about the expertise within government, what are the different kinds of expertise, primarily within the executive branch, but maybe range a bit broader than that too?
Yeah, no, good question. So, you can really... of course, there are many different subject matters that one might be expert in. You could, I suppose, categorize the kind of expertise agencies are likely to have into two big buckets, depending on provenance. One is a kind of expertise from long experience on the job. So this is the kind of expertise that you find in much of the writings of Landis during the New Deal. There's a kind of expertise that you might have from long familiarity with a particular regulatory regime or a particular industry. There's another kind of expertise that you might have from long study, right? The kind of expertise you might have if you are an epidemiologist, right? Your expertise of with respect to epidemiology would be based on your extended study. The point that I seek to make in my paper is that both of these kinds of expertise are fundamentally communicable. Most obviously, with respect to the latter kind of expertise, someone taught you what you know. Presumably, you could teach someone else. You could pass on the knowledge that has been passed along to you. But the same is also true with respect to the first kind of expertise. Knowledge of how a statutory scheme works could be explained to another. You could point the other to what you've seen about how the statutory scheme works and explain the chain of inferences that justify you in making the assertions that you make. It's a perfectly communicable kind of expertise. And indeed, Weber says somewhere in a passage that I cite in the paper, the kind of knowledge upon which bureaucracies act is quintessentially communicable. That's what makes it susceptible of reliance by a bureaucratic apparatus, as opposed to, I suppose, what Weber would call it, a charismatic ruler or some other form of rule.
I thought the paper did a good job getting into that when you distinguished between the expertise that an agency might have and then the specific expertise of a staff member inside that agency. Can you walk us through that distinction and how that's relevant to your argument about deference?
Yes. So perhaps the best reason to believe that agency expertise that affects the content of regulations is communicable is that it is almost all communicated, or at least almost all of it that bears on the most important regulations. So, in the paper, I offer a hypothetical example of how agency expertise might come to influence a regulation. There's variability in the details, but it runs something like this. The expertise that's relevant for a particular rulemaking is in the mind of an agency staffer. It's almost never in the mind of the agency head. Agency heads are selected sometimes for their familiarity with a particular statutory scheme, but almost never because they know the most about a particular provision or a particular scientific or technical problem. They're selected for their leadership skills and their political qualities and their alignment with the president's policy vision, all these other factors, almost never because they are what we would say in executive parlance is subject matter expertise. They might be subject matter experts, but they are almost never the deepest or most thoroughly knowledgeable subject matter experts on any particular question. So the way agency subject matter expertise is brought to bear on a problem is that the subject matter experts or SMEs have to communicate their expertise. And they have to communicate it to many, many people. First, they have to communicate it to others on their own team who lack their expertise. They have to communicate it to their own leadership, that is to say, the head of their office in their agency, and then eventually to their agency head. They have to communicate it to OIRA in the course of OIRA review, and through OIRA to the broader executive branch, to all those agencies, White House officials who review agency regulations. And of course, they have to communicate that expertise, at least in some measure, to the agency lawyers and then the DOJ lawyers who will eventually defend the rule in court if it's challenged. So in my experience, agency expertise is very, very often the subject of extensive communication within the executive branch. And that's one principal reason for believing that it's communicable.
So one part of your argument depends on the cost of sharing that information. So you've discussed sharing information within the executive branch. And then if you're communicating with outside general counsels or whatnot across the executive branch, that might translate into judicial communication. Are there examples where the cost of that communication would be higher than the cost that might be associated with judicial deference?
Yeah, good question. So let me take a step back before I answer the question and say there are really two goals of my paper. One is to tee up the question of communicability for the expertise rationale. And then second is to sketch a reason to believe or a reason to be skeptical of the expertise rationale on communicability grounds. So let me just explain a little bit this distinction that I want to draw. The first argument the paper makes, and really its heart, is that the expertise rationale is unpersuasive as currently articulated by the courts, because the courts do not engage the point of communicability. I say that the expertise rationale could justify deference only in cases in which four conditions are met. The agency knows something. Knowing that thing makes a decision that the agency is considering potentially better than ignorance of the thing the agency knows. The agency, in fact, uses the knowledge that it has. And then the court cannot acquire the knowledge that the agency has. And I say that the first three conditions have been picked up by judicial opinions, but the fourth has not. Courts tend to assume that because an agency has expert knowledge, and a court does not, at a certain point in time, that things must remain that way. And the agency must maintain its expertise uncommunicated to the court. Seems like a funny assumption to make, since courts all the time hear from counsel about all kinds of other knowledge they don't have. Presumably, that's the role of competent counsel, is to inform the court about things they didn't know before the litigation started. So, all to say, the main point of the paper, the heart of the paper, is to argue that if the expertise rationale is to be persuasive, then it must grapple with the communicability problem. It needs to explain why undoubtable costs of deference, making the government in some degree judge in its own cause, that the costs of deference are nevertheless warranted because the costs of communicability are so very high. All to say, that's the principal argument of the paper. I think I want to make a second argument that, in fact, there are reasons to believe that the costs of communication are not terribly high. And the reason to believe they're not terrible, the cost of communication, that is to say, between or from the agency to the court of the agency's expert knowledge. The reason I think that, at least in many cases, they're not terribly high is precisely on account of communication that's already happening within the executive branch. To put the argument in short form, if the subject matter expert at the agency can communicate his or her expertise to the head of their office and head of their agency and OIRA and DOJ and White House Counsel's Office and various other agencies, there just isn't a good reason to think that it would be terribly costly to communicate the expertise to a court. The official or the agency might be able to rely on some of the previous communications within the executive branch to shape the communication to courts. I'm sure it's the case that there are sometimes it would be more difficult to communicate expertise to a court than to other executive branch reviewers. I say in the paper that that's more likely to be the case where regulations are of relatively modest importance, or at least the interpretation that the expertise in question is relevant to is of relatively modest importance. In those cases, other executive branch reviewers may be disinclined to press for a thoroughgoing explanation of agency expertise. And so this agency subject matter experts' expertise might sort of pass through all the layers of review essentially unchallenged and so unexplained. And then you come upon judicial review, and there might be extensive costs to the SME to formulate for the first time an explanation of expertise that has lain unchallenged throughout the executive proceedings. But the point I make in my paper is that that's likely to happen where the interpretations don't matter very much. Where they matter a lot, then executive branch officials really want to know why we're taking, where they're going to take the position the subject matter expert wants them to take. They're likely to press pretty hard for an explanation that they can understand. And so the subject matter experts are likely to have advanced an explanation of their expertise that is intelligible to generalist reviewers, and so we might think susceptible to the understanding of generalist judges as well.
You know, Paul, I want to explore that point about what exactly the agency leaders and even the president might be looking for as they carry out their own sort of responsibilities and their own form of expertise. But Jace, could we maybe look at Chevron for a minute?
Sure. I was going to stop us for a minute and say that the reference of relatively minor or modest questions reminded me of another Gray Center working paper. There was a critique of the major questions doctrine saying that, okay, if we're putting so much emphasis on these big policy decisions, what happens with the run-of-the-mill minor questions? And if that's where the majority of policy is made, then wouldn't deference to those decisions potentially raise a bigger problem? But that gets into the quantification of these qualitative judgments. And I think Adam has a question about that later on.
Well, yeah. And far be it from me, by the way, to ever step on a podcast discussion of yet another Gray Center paper. So I'm already red jumping in. But Paul, you know, the themes you've raised so far regarding expertise and deference, I mean, they carry through so many aspects of administrative law, whether it's the State Farm doctrine and the court's reluctance to look into the heads of decision makers, but yet the court's, you know, eagerness to create the standards of review and to emphasize procedures that draw out explanations of deference. We're focused, I think, primarily here, or at least we should focus maybe today on Chevron, right? After all, that was the event that we had last fall, Professor Mascott's conference, Chevron on Trial, where you keynoted the conference with a conversation with her about this paper. And needless to say, this year, especially with the Loper-Bright and Relentless cases happening at the Supreme Court, a lot of people are thinking about judicial deference to statutory interpretations and agency expertise. So let's focus more squarely on that, at least for a little while. How do the themes that you explore in your paper tie into the broader debates about Chevron and agency expertise?
Yeah, a really important question. So, in both Chevron and in the Auer line of cases, there are three main rationales. There are a few minor rationales that are not common to the two lines of cases, but there are three main rationales that are common to both. One is what I refer to as the expertise rationale. Courts ought to defer to agencies because agencies know more about important things relevant to the interpretations at issue than courts do. The second is the accountability rationale. The courts are not accountable politically. Agencies are, and that matters in some way for interpreting statutory or regulatory text. And the third, and the ultimately decisive rationale, is rooted in an inference about congressional intent, that courts ought to defer because Congress wants courts to defer. A point I make early in the paper is that that third rationale, while, as I said, decisive, that is to say, ultimately the courts defer because they claim Congress wants them to defer. The reason the courts believe Congress wants them to defer is because of the first two rationales. Courts purport to believe that Congress believes that because agencies are expert and accountable, and courts are neither of those things, that the deference is appropriate. So my paper takes issue with, I'll say, one and a half of the three rationales that are in play. It takes issue with the expertise rationale and the congressional intent rationale insofar as grounded on the expertise rationale. It does not take issue with the accountability rationale. That's a separate kettle of fish.
I thought the paper did a good job just tying back to the earlier part of our conversation. You gave the original Chevron dispute over the bubble concept as an example of how the agency could have communicated that knowledge. Can you walk us through briefly that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and this is, by the way, not meant to be a historical account of how the bubble concept actually came into being. But it's indeed, I think it's actually a historical, it's premised on my understanding of how the executive branch works today with OIR review as it works today. It's not how it worked back when the bubble concept was advanced. So the way something like the bubble concept would come into being today is it would, it could come into being in one of two ways. It could come in response to a higher level political directive, right? Perhaps the bubble concept, high-level decision maker, conceivably even the president, quite unlikely, but conceivable, makes the judgment that interpreting an ambiguous statute to, in favor of the bubble concept is more consistent with the democratic mandate held by the president at a given moment. Now, that would, of course, not implicate the expertise rationale. That would implicate the accountability rationale, not the subject of my paper. The other way that something like the bubble concept could come to be enshrined in regulations is as a product of agency expertise. That is to say, a subject matter expert, in this case, an EPA, after spending some time implementing the Clean Air Act and thinking through what works and what doesn't work, and perhaps through perusing records of the deliberations that led to the enactment of the relevant statutory provisions, or perhaps even participating in giving technical assistance to Congress as it drafts the provisions in the first place, might form a view about the best way to interpret a statutory provision to achieve congressional intent. This EPA staffer might say, the best way to get what Congress was after in the Clean Air Act amendments is to implement the bubble concept. But of course, the bubble concept it's controversial. Made it all the way to the Supreme Court for a reason. So we can expect the staffer to participate in a pretty robust proceeding inside his agency, inside EPA. A proceeding that would involve probably dozens, maybe hundreds of agency staff. He would, for instance, talk to economists who would help assess the costs and benefits of the bubble concept. He would talk to agency lawyers who would provide some of the legal underpinning for that appears in the preamble to the proposed and final regulations. And of course, he would talk to his own leadership, to the head of the Air Office and the current EPA org chart. He would perhaps talk to the EPA administrator eventually. Once the proposed and then later the final regulation implementing the bubble concept had been prepared within the agency, the regulation would be submitted to OIRA review. The review process administered by the office that I had the privilege of heading. OIRA review is a bit of a misnomer. It does involve OIRA's review of draft regulations, but it also involves review of those regulations by other executive branch reviewers who participate in the process, other agencies, White House offices, etc. And those, all those reviewers, OIRA and the other executive reviewers, are entitled to push back on a regulation if they want. They're entitled to give feedback to the agency, and if their feedback is not accepted, to elevate the incipient dispute to higher and higher levels of executive officialdom, seeking a favorable resolution. The reason that process is important for my paper is that it creates more and more opportunities for reviewers, more and more senior reviewers, to demand explanations from agencies. And the more senior a reviewer is, the less likely they are to have serious subject matter expertise. And so the more likely they are to need an explanation that is couched in relatively general terms, the kind of terms that a judge would be perfectly capable of understanding. So one of the arguments of my paper is that the OIRA process assists in the creation of explanations internal to the executive branch that then reassure us that external communication, that is to say communication to the courts, would be relatively low cost.
And then broadening out a little bit, you mentioned that your paper is not talking about the accountability rationale for Chevron, and if we do undermine the expertise rationale, or it's incomplete, what principles should judges use when they're approaching statutory ambiguity?
Yeah, so I did talk a little bit about the accountability rationale at the conference, that the Gray Center, really excellent conference that the center hosted a few months ago. The accountability rationale seems pretty incomplete to me, too. I can get into it here at the same level of detail, since I haven't written a paper of this length on it. But the accountability rationale is troubling because it seems to presume that that the president, who is of course the font of all democratic accountability for the officials who are issuing regulations, that the president in some way steps into the could step into the shoes of the agency officials tasked with interpreting statutes and regulations, right? The idea seems to be that courts are at a sort of a disadvantage. They experience a kind of democratic deficit with respect or in comparison to agency heads, because the agency heads under the president, because of the president's supervision of them, adopt an approach to interpretation that is appropriately influenced by the people's views, right? Where interpretation has room to go in a few different directions. The problem with that rationale is that presidents are elected to pursue a vast number of goals and projects. And of course, they bring some of their own goals and projects to the office not infrequently. And it's awfully tempting to presidents to repurpose statutes to pursue ends that Congress didn't have in mind. And after all, Congress's democratic mandate is stronger than the president's. Surely the president is more accountable than judges, but he also has incentives to skew the interpretation of statutes to achieve goals they weren't ever intended to achieve in the first place. And that seems deeply problematic, and I don't think accountability is a really ameliorates that problem. So all to say, I'm pretty skeptical of both rationales for deference, and so the conclusion would be that deference is inappropriate, at least as currently formulated in the Chevron and Auerlein cases.
Can you talk a little bit about why judges have a different institutional incentive and why there isn't so much of a danger that they'll make more mistakes, assuming that they understand all of the issues that they need to make proper interpretation?
Yeah, so the point I made in the talk at the conference wasn't that necessarily that presidents are likely to arrive at worse interpretations, or that officials operating under the supervision of the president are likely to arrive at worse interpretations than judges, so much as it's a complicated question, right? Judges and officials subject to the president have incentives that point in just different directions, right? And so there are reasons to believe that we might think actually that presidents are going to and the officials subject to them are going to do better on some questions than judges, but we might think they're likely to do worse on others. And this is to shamelessly trench upon the domain of another Gray Center podcast. This is an issue, and I think an issue implicated by the major questions cases. All of the most recent major questions cases involve very, very substantial public presidential involvement in rulemakings, and hashing out the interpretation of statutes. It seems highly unlikely that presidents are doing anything like judges are doing when they participate in rulemakings. They aren't engaged in the close reading of statutory texts. They're pursuing a political objective, right? The pursuit of that political objective may or may not be related to the purposes of Congress in enacting the statute. And so I think you see in all the regulations subject to the most recent major questions challenge, successful challenges, that presidential influence can push an agency toward a strained interpretation of a statute. I don't think that judges have the same kinds of incentives that presidents do to strain interpretations. At least in important cases. Maybe the incentives are very different in less important cases.
You know, Paul, that actually goes right to, I think, my main takeaway from your paper, or at least not my takeaway, but the thing I was left thinking the most about after reading your paper again. And it just has to do with the nature of the president's role in our constitutional system. It seems to me very strange that in modern doctrines like Chevron deference, we put the president front and center, right? The democratic accountability of the presidency, along with his control over the agencies. But at the same time, when we turn to focus on expertise in all of that, I'll put it this way: the founders didn't envision a president who would be a technocrat. Right? Is the vocabulary of the constitutional presidency and how a president would relate to the other parts of government and especially to the people themselves was not through a rhetoric of cost benefit analysis, which they didn't really have back then. But you know, they had scientists, they had experts, and they knew that the president ultimately would have to connect with the people, partly on the people's own terms. Right? He would have to meet the people where they were. Of course, the president would be a statesman. And a leader, an elite, we might say. But ultimately, the president was not, his job was not going to be to defend his administration purely in terms of expertise. He was a statesman. And second to that, the theory of the presidency, and especially in things like Federalist 70, was that the president was going to be responsible for prudential judgments, right? Prudential judgments that often would have to be kept in secret, that even when in public, they might not be easy to sort of explicate, that there is a kind of, I don't know if you call it expertise, but maybe a kind of expertise in the presidency itself that doesn't really, isn't readily susceptible to sitting down and explaining, here's why I did this, here was my decision tree, here's my evidence at each step of the decision. President has to make prudential judgments either because administration requires him to strike so many balances or because administration requires a president to ultimately make decisions at a given moment in time based on factors that he or she himself or herself might not be able to boil down to a decision memo. And it seems to me that your office, again, the role you occupied in the White House, sort of exemplifies that irony, that your job was to help maintain a framework for improving and bringing up expertise up towards the presidency. But ultimately, the president, and not just the president you served under, but any president, it's going to have to make prudential or statesmanlike decisions that just aren't readily susceptible to a vocabulary of technical expertise. Am I overthinking that? And if not, maybe the role of expertise in administration at the presidential level is even less justified than you'd admitted to.
Yeah, I know. I think it's a phenomenal point. There's a way in which the two rationales for, and it's been remarked in the literature, that the two rationales for Chevron are in competition in some way, right? It's highly unlikely that the president brings to his job a kind of technical expertise that's going to shape a regulatory interpretation. By the way, I'm just chuckling inside now about the thought of the president engaging in serious cost benefit analysis himself, you know, the CBA preparer in chief. So the president's judgments are certainly in some ways the opposite of technically expert judgments. I think that's right. And I think it was the founders would not be surprised that's the case. You mentioned Federalist 70. And I'm getting a little bit far afield from my paper, so I don't take this as gospel. But I'm always struck by a line in Federalist 70 where Publius says he's talking about the reason the Constitution doesn't adopt the model of a plural executive. He's talking about the dangers of deliberation. Of the kind of deliberation that the Constitution promotes and relies on in Article 1. So talking about the downsides of that kind of what you might call multipolar deliberation within the executive. And he says very strikingly, no favorable, I'm quoting here, I pulled it up when you mentioned Federalist 70, no favorable circumstances palliate or atone for the disadvantages of dissension in the executive department. It's a really striking line, because it seems to mean not just that there are there would be the loss of of dispatch and secrecy from deliberation, but that there wouldn't actually be anything good attained by multipolar deliberation within the executive branch, which suggests that the kinds of matters presidents are entrusted with are not the kinds of matters that would benefit from the kind of anti-faction protections talked about in Federalist 10 and Federalist 51, right?
Yeah.
The president's going to be pursuing goals that Americans might disagree about, but for the most part, not those on which we're going to have antithetical interests, right? So Congress, for instance, declares war, or that a fight a particular country might advantage or disadvantage different Americans. But once Congress has declared war, well, winning the war, that's something that we really should all favor, and the president is well suited to pursue. Anyway, so all to say, I'm struck by the fact that the interpretations in which presidents tend to get involved, frankly, do involve factionalism, right? Yeah. You could see that most obviously in the student loan case, right? I'll call it as I see it. That seems like to be factionalism, pure and simple. I think the founders would have been really surprised to see that the president is making decisions about matters of that sort.
Yeah, and when you say earlier about the fact that the presidency, presidential administration, in the founders' sense, is not well suited to multipolar deliberation. It's not that they're against deliberation per se, right? That's the point of Federalist 76. The president doesn't get to pick his own cabinet unilaterally. He needs to get Senate confirmation, Senate advice and consent. So that there's a great line in there. I won't get it exactly right, but I think Publius says, so the president will be ashamed. He'd be embarrassed to appoint people of such pliancy and little significance that they'd be nothing more than obsequious instruments of the president's pleasure, right? And the upshot of that is that, you know, in the founder's sense, the vision of this, they wanted the president to have advisors, to have cabinets, now you know, call them cabinet secretaries, who will deliberate with him, who will maybe push back a little bit. But at the end of the day, the president's going to have to make decisions, and that's where Federalist 70 and the need for swift execution kicks in. Where I'm going with all this, though, is we were reading your paper last fall and again now this winter. You know, at a moment when there's a steady stream of books coming out from people who are more favorable towards sort of a technocratic administrative state, books that defend the legitimacy of modern administration, really in terms of rational decision-making. I'm thinking of books by Sid Shapiro and others, whether they're the cost-benefit books that Ricky Revesz has co-authored or other books about the modern administration as exemplifying reasoned decision-making. I always read those books, and I think this is an argument that will convince administrative law scholars and judges, I think, and people within agencies. But it strikes me as totally orthogonal to the sense of the constitutional presidency the founding generation had about exactly what administration was about. And so I think your paper it fits really well within those debates, and I think it's an interesting juxtaposition with those books, the books are interesting to read. Again, I'm at the Center for the Study of the Administrative State, so it's really, you know, Amazon put it right in my algorithm without even asking me. It was that easy. But I do think those books somewhat miss the case of what constitutional administration really is about.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Adam.
Turning back to what those administrators might be thinking, what do you think the reaction from the regulatory community, and specifically agency staff, would be if it was expected that they were supposed to communicate their expertise with reviewing courts?
So I think the outcry would be loudest from the lawyers and not from the subject matter experts. I think that your typical subject matter expert at an agency has a lot of faith in his or her ability to communicate expertise to judges. I say that because they seem, you know, most subject matter experts seem comfortable communicating their expertise within the executive branch, right? I didn't I didn't often find, perhaps on occasion, but I didn't often find, when I was in government, that subject matter experts would just invoke their expertise as a kind of shield from explanation, right? Perhaps sometimes, but typically, someone who knows something important and believes himself or herself capable of communicating it in a matter that's important to them is keen to communicate it. So I don't know. I don't think that subject matter experts would be unduly miffed by having to communicate it to judges as well. And I think they could do a fine job of it.
So given that answer, maybe your response to my next question is no, but do you envision that there's anything Congress should do to facilitate that communication, or is there anything we need from the first branch?
Overruling Chevron, either judicially or legislatively, of course, would prompt giving better explanations. No question about that. So that's the short and easy answer to your question.
Well, on that point, actually, this is probably my last question, but you're in Washington, I'm in Washington, and like everybody in Washington, we'll read the eventual Loper-Bright and Relentless cases for decisions for two things. One, how does the majority opinion prove us right? Or two, what has the majority opinion given us to write about next? I'm curious, as when those decisions come down, probably at some point early this summer, and you crack them open, what will you be looking for in terms of any court analysis of expertise? Obviously, you'll be looking to see whether Chevron is renounced, retained, or just reformed. But surely, given your work in this paper, you'll be reading this with an eye to discussions of expertise in administration and interpretation. What are you on the lookout for?
Yeah, so I say at the very beginning of the paper that there are two different perspectives or two different categories of perspectives that that you might bring to the deference debates. One is an external perspective, and one is an internal perspective. You might have an external or an internal critique. The distinction let me put it this way. Many of the arguments against Chevron are based on what I will call external critiques. That is to say, assuming that expertise might give an agency a leg up in interpreting a statute. Nevertheless, it comes with costs that we shouldn't be prepared to bear. And I'm extremely sympathetic to those arguments. I think they're right. As I said earlier, Chevron, to some degree, makes agencies judges in their own causes. And Phil Hamburger likes to put it that way. And I think he's right to put it that way. So it might be that Loper-Bright and Relentless are decided on the basis of external critiques of Chevron. And that, I think, would be a fair way to decide the case and the cases and all the court really needs to do to decide the cases. I'll be reading with a particular attention to whether the court says anything about internal critiques. That is to say, even putting aside the external critiques, are there reasons to doubt that expertise would be enough to warrant deference anyway? Obviously, that's what my paper is about. So I'll be keen to see what the court does with those kinds of critiques.
Does that have any bearing on Justice Kagan's question about what should happen when the law runs out? Is that a question about expertise? Is there an amount of subject matter expertise that would answer such a question?
Yeah, so it seems to me that when the law runs out, you're not really interpreting anymore, right? If the law has truly run out, then you might be in a domain of agency discretion. Alternatively, the law might have run out in such a way that that it means that for the agency to fill in, to answer the question would be to engage in the exercise of power unconstitutionally delegated. That's another possible consequence of the law running out. But in neither case do I think you really engage the interpretive enterprise anymore. And that's why I don't find that kind of defense of Chevron very persuasive.
In that case, I just have one more question for you, and it's, what should other people who are interested in separation of powers or administrative law more broadly get out of your paper that we haven't already talked about?
So I would encourage everyone, but especially administrative law scholars, to be interested in things other than administrative law. Most relevantly here, administrative practice, the way things actually work within the executive branch, right? Adam, you made a point earlier about arguments that are appealing to administrative lawyers or students of administrative law. It can be very tempting to have a kind of mental construct of administration that is basically informed by the opinions of courts reviewing regulations or other agency action. That is it's very hazardous to make public policy on the basis of a mental construct like that. There is a great deal that happens in administration of course it's occurring in a universe shaped by administrative law, but it's you can't really know it from the cases. You have to know it from either having participated in the process yourself or reading accounts of those who've done so. So I would just really encourage anyone interested in these topics to take administration as it happens on the ground at least as seriously as administrative law.
Thank you for joining us on Gray Matters. And for everyone listening, I hope you'll go and read Paul's paper as soon as it's published. And we'll have links to that on our website and in the show notes here.
All right. Thanks, guys.
This has been an episode of Gray Matters. If you enjoyed this discussion, check out all of our episodes on our website at administrativestate.gmu.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @AdLawCenter.